Anne Selby, Reel 5. Yes, this buddy-buddy system. You went round checking, did you, each other?
Yes. The idea was that, you know, anything that you'd left undone, somebody else could easier find and check for you. So, therefore, it was just something you automatically were supposed to do. This is what I did when the explosion went off. I went round and asked if everybody was okay. And because I had my kit on, I asked somebody to check me, and I checked them, and that was the way it was. And, of course, by the time everybody got their kit on, normally, and under circumstances that it always been before, the all clear had sounded by this time. But this time, the all clear did not sound. So everybody congregated in the corridor, inside corridor, and one of the everyone was waiting to see what would happen. And we could hear the sound of people running and shouting outside, and we weren't quite sure what was going on. So I said, look, I said, somebody needs to go out and find out what's happening. So it was myself and another staff sergeant, but Nurse Quarren, who actually went out, a girl called Dee Luxton. And we went out, the pair of us, and as we went out, we could see people running past, all dressed in noddy suits. And the alarms were going off, and we could hear NIAID going off. Now, NIAID was the chemical alert, chemical sentry. So NIAID generally doesn't go off unless there's chemicals in the air. So we're standing there on the steps of this, and theoretically, you were supposed to go down into these huge pipes, which they sandbagged, and these were like your air raid shelters, so to speak. But they were all on ground level, and nobody ever wanted to go in them. So everybody tended to stay in the building, kind of in the central corridor, so that you had a little bit of added protection. And because we didn't come under direct attack with mortars, you know, the idea of going into these pipes seemed a little bit ludicrous. And Wendy and I looked at the pipes, we could actually see like this faint mist sort of standing up from about 18 inches from the ground, sort of halfway up the pipe. And in the military, you have something for nuclear, for NDC, which is called an immediate action drill. And part of the immediate action drill is, if you hear any strange noises, if you hear any explosions, if you see any strange unidentified aircraft, if you see any strange mists, smell any strange smells, if you hear the chemical alert, which is NIAID, or the chemical alert temporary, which is two mess tins, two metal objects bound together, or somebody shouting gas, 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 then the rule is you mask up. That is the immediate action drill. And so, therefore, we were hearing a lot of these things. First, we heard an explosion, felt an explosion. We could see this mist. We hadn't seen any strange aircraft, but we had a strange scud explode. And we couldn't smell anything, obviously, because we were indoors, we had respirators. But NIAID was going off. So, in view of all of those and this mist, I mean, we obviously came to the conclusion that obviously something was up here. And of course, nobody, we asked one of the guys going back, and he was part of the cascade system, and he said, you need to check. He says, I'm going up as far as here. He said, you need to check back that way. So I had to go back into the other buildings and actually make sure that they had all responded to the alert, because that's what the cascade system is. It kind of fountains out from a central position, and runners go out to the first part, and then runners go out from that first part to the second part, and it literally fans outwards so that everybody is covered. Now, cascade isn't usually initialized unless there's a definite threat. So that said to me that there was a threat, the fact that they'd initiated the cascade system. So here we are in the middle of what is almost certainly a real alert. And we were like that. I think we were in our NBC kit for something like 5 or 6 hours. And finally they gave us the stand down, and we all stood down and de-kitted. And everything kind of went back to normal, but nobody gave any explanations. So when I went to work the next day, our boss, of course, had been at the briefing at the O Group, Orders Group, at HGFMA, with the very high-ranking officers, like the Commander Supply and people like that. And, of course, he got the lowdown. And he came back, and we waited for our briefing. And he said, okay, he said, with regard to the explosion and the alert last night, he said, I'm not going to make any comments. He says, I'm going to tell you what I've been told. He says, and I'm going to leave you to draw your own conclusions. He says, it was a sonic boom. It was an aircraft jettisoning and igniting its load of fuel. It was a Scud. NIAID went off because they were crop spraying, because Al Jubail's chemical company was venting its stacks, you know, the big stacks where they actually vent occasionally, or there was nerve agent contained in the Scud. It's up to you. And he went away, left it at that. That was the briefing. And he looked fed up. I must admit, he looked fed up. So it seems to me as though, rather than tell the truth, they'd actually given everybody the runaround. But I am telling you exactly what we were told. So this isn't his opinion. This is just, you know, this is a man coming and offering us choices. Okay, take a pick. You know, it's like an A, B, and C, you know, selection. You know, a multi-choice examination. You know, tick the right box or whatever. So. Anybody with any intelligence would realise there actually weren't any crops around Al Jubail. So therefore couldn't have been crop spraying. And if a chemical company vents its stacks and sends chemicals up into the air, well then, heaven help people who normally lived in Al Jubail, and you know, I'm surprised that any of them were alive at all. So therefore, you know, it had to be some kind of traces of nerve agent. The one thing that he did tell us was that the actual Scud had exploded in Al Jubail Harbour and was actually sticking about South Harbour, which was afterwards denied by the British military when we tasked him about it when over the Gulf War Syndrome thing. They've actually denied that happened. And yet, myself and another sergeant went down and he took pictures of it. So we know it happened. You know, we actually saw it. And they denied it happened afterwards. And of course, as for the explosions, I mean, yes, I suppose it could have been a sonic boom, or it could have been an aircraft jettisoning its load, but I don't think that the explosion would have rumbled through the ground like that. It was a ground explosion, it was a ground impact, because we felt the vibrations through the floor. And then we felt the explosion itself. So, you know, it was definitely something. And that was one of the ones that came fairly close.
Did the start of the land war make much difference to your job when the land war started?
The run-up to the land war was very, very tense. And mainly because I think that they didn't know what kind of resistance they were going to get. I think they didn't realise that the resistance was going to be quite as pathetic as it actually was. Obviously, there were pockets of the Iraqi army did fight back. But mostly, its crack troops had been withdrawn. He'd withdrawn them up as far as Baghdad, I believe. So therefore, what was left were the conscripts. And of course, they were very badly equipped. They were badly... They had little or no weapons. They had very little food. Their officers had literally, once they realised that the Allied armies were advancing, they a lot of them up and deserted these conscripts. And I can only tell you from an account from a friend who'd actually been with one of the other units in the desert, and they had actually advanced, and they were part of the medical unit, but they had advanced and they were approached by a group of Iraqis who were literally stripping off their clothes as they came because they wanted to show the Allied soldiers that they didn't have anything they could threaten them with, because they'd been told by their superiors, apparently, the guys who deserted them, that if the Allied armies got to them, they would just shoot them, they would just kill them. You know, treat them very badly. So they were literally taking off their clothes and saying, look, we're no threat. And when they were asked to identify themselves, was, I mean, which is really crazy because, you know, you can't assume that they speak English, a lot of them. They were, this guy was actually answered by an American voice, who said, and by a guy who said, hi, don't shoot, I'm from Chicago. When he spoke to this guy after, he sought him out afterwards and he spoke to him, and apparently this guy was Iraqi, but he was born in America from of Iraqi parents, and he had been in Baghdad visiting his grandparents and his parents' families when the war broke out, and they took his American passport out of him and conscripted him. And so there they are, this American, hi, I'm an American citizen, you know, please don't shoot, you know. It was that kind of thing. You know, the whole of the war was filled with little anomalies like that. And then, of course, in the middle of all of this, when the Iraqis fled from Kuwait City, they fled along the stretch of the road near a place called Mutla Ridge, and it was the Basra Road. And of course, the Americans, who are forever trigger happy, decided that they were trying to stop these people from running. So they bombed the road and shut it off, effectively shut it off. Now, because a lot of the Iraqis were fleeing in ordinary cars and things that didn't have four-wheel drive, of course, there was really a place for them to go. Maybe things like Range Rovers could cross the desert, and obviously a lot of the people did actually try to avoid the smog bombing by turning off into the desert, but most of the people that were fleeing could not escape this bomb alley that the Americans created. And of course, the Americans, once started, don't know how to stop. And they kept bombing these people. And I think it took another one of the Allied senior officers to actually get hold of the person in charge and say, look, you have to stop. I can't be sure about this, and I don't really know my facts, but I've been aware of having been told this. How true it is, I don't know. But apparently they were told that they had to stop because literally they turned it into a sort of almost like a turkey shoot. And basically they just bombed hell out of everything that moved.
Did you get that yourself while you were in the Gulf? You know, did you see pictures of that? Did you know what was going on with that Mutla Road?
Yes, I did.
You did, yeah.
Yes, I did know what was going on. I actually saw part of it. So therefore...
Yeah, on the television? Did you really? Did you go up to that area?
Yes, I was up in that area.
Yes, when did you go up into that area?
I was in that area about 7 hours after it happened.
Did you go into Kuwait City first?
No, I didn't. I didn't go into Kuwait City at all. I was up there totally by accident. I really shouldn't have been there at all. And, you know, from what I saw, you know, it wasn't a place that I know anything. Although I do know that the Americans actually were busing loads of their troops in to actually see it, like it was some kind of tourist thing. And, of course, you know, there were people... But I have nightmares about that particular. I had nightmares about that particular aspect of it, because of course at the same time as all of this is going on, bear in mind my own personal situation is not getting any better because I'm now totally separated from my kids. I don't know what's going on with them. I'm trying to contact them back in England, and the phone's just ringing off the wall, so I don't know whether my kids are alive or dead or anything. I ring my friend, I managed to get to a phone, because they gave us a phone card, and I managed to call Mal, and she said that she kept ringing all the time. She said, I can't get through at all, I don't know what's happened. So at this time, I'm demented, because all of the strange situations going on around me, and at the same time, I'm worried sick about the boys, because I don't know what's happened. So finally, in desperation, I go to the welfare officer on camp, and I tell her what's been happening. She contacts G1 in London, G1, G4, which is welfare and discipline in London, and they contact SAFO in Newcastle, who actually send a sapper representative round to the house to find out what's happening with my kids. And when he got there, he discovered that my ex-husband had actually left them. He'd actually walked out, left them, and he'd gone to live somewhere else. They had no food. They had no food. And anyway, they got him back into the house. And also, what he'd been doing is, he'd been coming and taking the post and throwing away my letters. And he'd been saying to them things like, your mother's not really in the girl, she's just doing this to get at me. And I know this for a fact, this is not just hearsay, because he actually, I was told by the commanding officer and by the RSN back at Blackdown when I got back home, that my husband had rung the guardroom on numerous occasions demanding to speak to me, and when he was told that I was serving out in the Persian Gulf, he told them that they were all in on the conspiracy and that they were deliberately trying to keep him from talking to me. So he made a hell of a nuisance of himself, so I had all that to face when I got back as well. So all of this was going on back then, although I didn't know about that. And I didn't at the time. They didn't tell me that he'd left and gone and lived somewhere else. All I was told by SAFA was that they'd gone round, they'd checked the boys, and the boys were okay, but they were in a bit of a state, that they'd received no letters, and I'd written every day. I'd written the blue every single day. And they'd not, he'd hidden all of them, he'd thrown them all away. And apparently they sat with Lee and Peter whilst they wrote me a letter, and the SAFA guy took it away and posted it to me. So that was the situation, which I finally got notified, because by this time the ground war is pulling to a close. It was only a week, so we are then almost coming up to what's, you know, almost like a wash-up. Rumours are flying around the camp that, you know, that basically the it's coming to an end and we're all going to get shipped out, but nobody knew when we were all going to get shipped back. And it was all happening, like, it didn't seem to have any rhyme or reason to it. But what we were told was, everybody was officially told that certain units were going back, and these were the units, the showcase units from the Gulf, under Patrick Cornelly, Brigadier Patrick Cornelly, who were going to go back, and they were going to be welcomed with all the, you know, farts and whistles at wherever it was they landed, and they were going to have the big fuss thing, and the rest of us were all just going to be shipped back in units. So immediately we were told that because we weren't part of the elite units, we were just support units, we were not important, and so therefore we didn't deserve this big welcome back. We were going to be shipped back like, you know, thieves in the night. And that's exactly how they did it. They didn't even give me, and I tell you what, I had 5 minutes warning. I was in bed. One of the young Lance Corporal, Sharon, came rushing up. She knocked at the door. She said, luckily, I had actually packed my kit. My kit had been packed for days. And she said to me, Staff, you've got to get ready. She said, the bus is leaving in 2 minutes. I had 2 minutes to get dressed and run around to that bus. She helped me carry my kit around. And that's how much notification that I got of us, our unit being shipped back. They literally just drove us in buses down to Dhahran, dumped us in Dhahran Airport. We could see the plane standing out on the tarmac. Now, I can't understand any of this treatment. We'd just been and been prepared to fight the main war for them. We'd put up with all of this crap, all of the stress. We suffered injections, vaccinations. We'd been made to take malaria tablets, Nax tablets, we'd been ill, we breathed in all this stuff, and they just shipped us to this airport, we could see this plane, and it was all fully fueled, it was ready to go, the staff were just standing by waiting for us to get on it, and they wouldn't let us on it, and we couldn't understand why not. Finally, because bear in mind, I think Sally is what, two or three hours behind here, I can't remember exactly how much, I think it's about 2 or 3 hours. What they did was, they waited until it would be too late for us to get back and hit the pubs when we got back. They also wanted to make sure we got back at a time so that nobody could be there to meet us. And we found out afterwards when we actually got into the airport at Bryce Norton, we landed, it was something like 1 o'clock in the morning. We were all ushered into this room to get our kit, and there were various high-ranking officers were kind of there in the general melee. We could see behind this glass civilians who were members of the families who I found out afterwards had not been officially told we were coming back. They'd found out kind of round the houses by word of mouth. And apparently these civilians, members of families, had actually got this news. They knew we were coming back. They went up to Bryce Norton. They were refused entry. And they tried to keep them outside of the airport because they didn't want any of the families to meet us. They had a couple of three representatives. I wasn't even met by a member of my own corps, WRSC. I was actually welcomed back by a Queen Alexandra nursing colonel who came and said, "Staff, welcome back." And the families weren't allowed to speak to the soldiers until the soldiers were released. Right? And of course, none of our lot actually had any family there because a lot of people that came back with us were reservists. And of course, what had happened was some of the reservists had managed to get to a phone when they realised they'd had warning of coming back, and they'd managed to get to a phone and they'd spoken to families, and families had spoken to other families, and word of mouth had passed down. And of course, all these relatives came down to meet the reservists because they were going to be just, you know, demobbed. For the rest of us who were regular soldiers, we all had to go back to units. So, of course, we were just quietly put onto buses and sent back to our units. And that was what happened. We went out in amongst all of the euphoria of kicking ass for the Iraqis and war and, you know, with all the little bells and whistles that are the kind of accompany all of that, and we came back like we slunk back into the United Kingdom, literally slunk back as though we'd done something that we should have been ashamed of, and everybody felt like that. It was very strange. And I remember that we'd set away very early that morning, something like 6 o'clock in the morning. We'd all been woken up and bumped on the buses in Al Jabal. Busted our run, we'd been made to stand in queues, we'd been made to hand. The other thing was that before we got to Dalaran, we were made to go through a big hangar-like building, and we were told to hand back all of the medications that we'd been issued before. And it was like almost like handing back contraband. We had to put them in these big boxes, NAPS tablets, the BATs, which were the biological agent tablets. We were told to put them all back. Anything that we had that related to medication or medical that we'd had when we were out there, including any antibiotics you might have had to take, all had to go into these contraband boxes. And we literally had to walk through, and they had military police there watching you do it. You had to empty the contents of your pouches and your webbing bag, and they would check through it. And everything that looked remotely like contraband was, in their eyes, was put in these boxes, and then you were passed through. And then you went to Dalaran. Then you sat around for hours and hours whilst the plane sat on the tarmac, plainly waiting to go. And bear in mind, most people, apart from me that had had the one drink with the major that time, most people had not had an alcoholic drink. We heard that on the official flight that went home, the one that went home with all the farts and whistles and what have you, they were actually given a beer to drink on the flight. And when they got back, Brigadier accordingly paraded his troops up, and everybody duly clapped and made a big fuss and everything. We were made to wait almost 24 hours before getting on the plane. We then got on the plane. When we got back, we were treated like a bunch of criminals, thrown onto buses, taken back to our units. And when our unit got back into lockdown barracks, the RSM of our particular lot and senior ranks were busy up in the sergeant's mess annex having a regimental dinner the night we arrived back. And it was a Saturday night, and they were having a regimental dinner, and when we got back, It was only the quartermaster who had actually known, who actually kind of acknowledged we were coming back. And he had one clerk on to de-kit us, and they'd arranged for a tea urn and a coffee urn and packed lunch, packed dinners for us when we got back. And there's this little clerk, this little corporal standing. Welcome. He was the one that welcomed the whole unit back, right? And we're all tired, we're all fed up, we're all dirty, and we're trying to hand this kit in, and he says, don't worry about it. He says, just dump it all in the corner. He says, we'll sort it out all in the morning. So anyway, by this time, the RSM had got news of the fact that his little unit, his little old unit, was back. Because although I had been detached, I actually went back with my with the Al-Jabal laundry platoon. I didn't go back with HQ 1 Armed Infantry Regiment. I actually went back with the laundry platoon. We went back in a unit, to the same unit. And we got there, and the corporal said to me, he said, staff, he said, you're the only, he says, you're the only one, he says, do you need accommodation? And I said, actually, no. I said, because I spoke to the mess the day before I left and asked and said, look, I'm probably going to be back within a few days. I said, and they've already arranged accommodation. And he rang up the mess, spoke to the duty guy who said, yes, there's a key for you, here for stuff. So she's got accommodation. He says, oh, good. He says, that gets a load off my mind. He says, I can get the rest of them all accommodated. So he's trying to organise their accommodation. And these two, three, this very drunken RSM came down fully dressed in regimental dinner kit, regiment mess kit. And he came down and he stood there, and I'll never forget it. We're all dirty. He's standing there having had a very pleasant dinner and a very pleasant evening and a few drinks. And he says, oh, so, he says, it's welcome back to the conquering heroes, is it? And me and another sergeant had to stop a senior warrant officer from actually grabbing him by the throat, because we had never said we were heroes, and we didn't think we were heroes. We went out there to do a job because they asked us to do it. And we didn't come back expecting a hero's welcome. But I think that we could have done with a better welcome than that, than a very obviously a fairly bitter sounding a senior NCO who, I don't know, maybe, I don't know what his thought was, but I think that what they'd heard was that it was a cushy number out there on the Doddle, and that, you know, we were all coming back, and we were supposed to have died, and we came back and we didn't die, and there we were all back, and nothing had really happened to us, you know. And, you know, really rather a lot had happened to us. It just hadn't happened to us the same way as, you know, as it had for other soldiers in other wars.
What was your health like at that time? Had you had any of the symptoms in the Gulf? You were saying you went out with flu, didn't you?
It degenerated into a horrific chest infection. I was coughing up blood. I was coughing up huge lumps of black stuff that I couldn't even begin to describe. And I did at one stage actually go and see the MO. This was probably about 3 weeks or so after I arrived there. And they gave me antibiotics, and I was instructed that if it hadn't cleared up in a week, that I was to come back, and that I would be casualty-evacuated immediately. That's evacuated, casualty evacuated back to the UK. And at that stage, I was fairly kind of suspicious, because they'd given us all of these vaccines. They'd given us a vaccine that had been classified. They wouldn't tell us. They just said it had a code name. And, of course, that was the plague vaccine. But they didn't tell us it was plague. They didn't release it was plague. It was called code name Cutter.
Cutter?
Cutter, yes.
C-U-T-T-E-R.
That's right. And when I went to actually get this particular vaccine, the doctor that gave it to me, she said, this is code name. She says, this is Cutter. And I said, we've had everything else. I said, so it has to be from bubonic plague. And she went as white as a sheet. And she looked at me and she said, how did you know? And I said, well, I've just told you. I said, you've given us everything else. I said, there isn't much left, is there, except bubonic plague? I said, is it the bubonic plague? And she said, it's pneumonic plague. But she said, I would like you not to actually reveal that to anybody, Stan.
Pneumonic?
Pneumonic plague.
P-N-E-U-M-O-N-I-C.
I presume so, yes.